Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
Now that the elections are over, leaders of the New York State Legislature are facing pressure from a wide range of groups to reconvene and deal with pandemic-related economic issues. Legislative leaders say they are not ruling it out. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports.
63 politically progressive advocacy groups wrote a letter to legislative leaders asking them to hold an emergency session before 2020 ends. Sia Weaver is with Housing Justice for All, one of the groups that signed the letter. She says COVID cases are again on the upswing and no federal aid has come from Congress since last April. She says New Yorkers who are struggling to find or keep their jobs and pay rent need more help from their state government.
The legislature has not met since June or July. We are working with families who have no idea how they're going to pay next month's rent, who have no idea how they're going to get medical care or feed their families. It's getting very urgent. And, you know, we need the legislature to go back to work and do their job.
The state has a $15 billion budget deficit, much of it pandemic-related, and Governor Andrew Cuomo has for months now temporarily held back 20% of state aid due to schools and local governments. Weaver says Cuomo has made clear that he is the austerity governor, and she believes the legislature ceded too much power to him over the past several months. She says instead of spending cuts, new taxes should be imposed on the state's billionaires and multimillionaires who have done well financially during the pandemic. Cuomo is against that idea, saying the rich will leave the state, but Senate Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins and Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie, both Democrats, support imposing new taxes on the wealthy.
The only time we've ever been able to get Cuomo to do anything is when Andrea Stewart-Cousins and Carl Hastie come together and make it clear that it's a priority for them.
Greg Barilla, with the New York State chapter of the National Federation of Independent Businesses, says even if the legislature does not come back for a session this year, he'd like to see lawmakers talk about how to help small businesses that have suffered economic losses during the pandemic. He says many employers worry about an expected spike in unemployment insurance payments in the spring after businesses were required by government health orders to close for several months. That triggered a year of unprecedented layoffs.
We are very concerned that we're going to get into the spring of next year and, knock on wood, COVID might be behind us or getting close to that point. We're going to see small businesses starting to plot their path forward, looking to grow, looking to hire, and they are going to be hammered with new costs and new taxes related to layoffs that were simply not their fault. These are things that may involve a federal solution or at least federal engagement, but the New York State Legislature and leadership in Albany needs to be thinking about it now.
Senate Leader Stewart-Cousins, speaking recently on public radio's The Capitol Press Room, said the legislature had no plans to meet again in what is known as a post-election lame duck session.
Is there any definitive plan to have a lame duck session? No.
Stewart Cousins says now that Democrat Joe Biden is the president-elect, she, like Cuomo, would like to wait a while to see if he can persuade Congress to enact a federal relief package that will close the state's deficit. Democrats in the House have approved an over $2 trillion plan. It would give $33 billion to New York state and local governments to cope with pandemic-related losses. Republicans in the U.S. Senate have not taken up the measure, but Biden backs the bill.
It is much more promising than having a Donald Trump, who was clearly an adversary.
A spokesman for Stewart-Cousins later clarified that the Senate leader is not ruling out a session of the legislature next month. Assembly Speaker Hastie, in a tweet, said that, to be clear, Assembly Democrats have also not ruled out a return to session this year to address the fiscal health of our state. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Come
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. Alan, the president got in a fight with Governor Cuomo, and it had to do with the COVID-19 vaccine, really laying on the governor the blame that he won't give New York the vaccine because the governor is trying to do preliminary tests on the vaccine to make sure it's safe, because the governor believes that the president has created mistrust in the virus and a possible vaccine. And there's the fight that's erupted. The governor obviously not backing down.
I have somebody who I know quite well who says that she will not take the vaccine while this president is here. That's the level of distrust in Trump that so many people have. I'm going to take the vaccine as soon as I can get it. Nevertheless, it is a time when every American is going to have to decide. And if you want to create what is called herd immunity, if you want the country to be safe, the vaccines are going to have to be taken. So when Cuomo says, I want to set up my own apparatus here to make sure that we're doing the right thing and that we're not going to hurt people, he's just reinforcing the idea that these vaccines need to be verified. We need to know what we're doing. We'll have a distinguished group. We'll take a look at it. I don't think that Cuomo is going to be able to prevail in this one. I think people who want the vaccine will find ways to get it. And I think there'll be a lot of pressure on the governor. He made this pronouncement before the vaccine was announced. So the fact that we go forward when you know very well that people are going to be clamoring for it will put an awful lot of pressure on Governor Cuomo. He has been assiduous in trying to do the right thing. And this is another example of sometimes cutting corners doesn't work. We have seen examples in the past where if you cut corners, there can be a certain amount of chaos as a result and a certain amount of mistakes.
Well, now that the elections are over, the leaders of the New York State Legislature and, as you point out, Governor Cuomo facing increasing pressure from a wide range of groups to reconvene and deal with the coronavirus-related economic issues. Our Karen DeWitt reported this week on that. But the issue, of course, is the governor has been waiting on this federal money. We've had an election come and gone. We don't have a second infusion, and people are really beginning to hurt now. And the question is, how do we fill the gap in the immediate future to help people stay afloat and get through this pandemic?
Well, there are going to be a lot of ways to do it. The state is seriously in debt. If Cuomo can outweigh Trump and Biden will turn things around and try to help with federal money, that's, I'm sure, what the plan is. Of course, as you know, Trump is doing everything in his power to resist the idea that he's been diselected, kicked out, kicked in the behind. And he is obviously angry about that. So he, as you know, always looks for somebody to start a fight with. In this case, it's Cuomo. He has his usual nonsense about making up all kinds of alternative reality situations, and he's doing that again. As for the legislative leaders in New York State, we're beginning to get the impression that they have ceded their powers to the governor. Hey, it's an emergency. An emergency like this country has never, ever faced. And so they're smart to do that. And as long as the governor does the right things, I have a feeling we're not going to see an awful lot of push from these people in the legislature.
You and I have been talking regularly about the president of the United States, once he's out of office and a private citizen, whether he will be prosecuted. We know that the attorney general of New York, Tish James, and the New York City district attorney, Cy Vance, have cases out against him. And we know now that President-elect Biden has said he would leave it up to an independent Justice Department to make that decision. But back to New York, I mean, there's a real chance he could be prosecuted.
Well, he could be, and in my view, he should be. You know, the idea that one person is above the law is absolutely antithetical to what we have always been led to believe. I mean, if a kid walks into a grocery store with a gun in his hand, he's going to spend an awful lot of time in jail. And somebody, because he was president, and a corrupt, in my mind, morally corrupt at least, president, is allowed to go free, there is a message that is given to an awful lot of people about what breaking the law brings you. So I'm thinking that this is a mess for those people who want to prosecute. My own personal belief is, let the Justice Department decide, but it's clear that Biden doesn't want that at the federal level. But at the state level, there's a question as to whether or not the word comes down from Washington that we don't need this. And, you know, you got Cy Vance, a Democrat. You got Tish James, a Democrat. Do they listen or do they proceed on their own?
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Giustina. The 2020 election was historic on a number of fronts. Voting patterns changed in some states and on many levels. Dr. Amy Bass, professor of sports studies at Manhattanville College in Westchester County, New York, says there's a new voting bloc, athletes. She spoke with the Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn.
I think that one of the most interesting pieces that have come out of this election in terms of, you know, who are sort of our stand-up spotlight people, and athletes emerged as a big one. But, you know, the NBA got so much attention in terms of its role in promoting election, voting, register to vote, and really the WNBA is where I think most of this spotlight belongs. As the WNBA emerged early on as a league that sort of had a social justice program attached to it. And we see on the local level, Georgia, Georgia, Georgia. I mean, I cannot think of a moment when Georgia has been so important in terms of electoral politics. So I think there's a couple things here. I think we see players agitating on behalf of candidates. So with the WNBA, you know, you have players wearing Vote Warnock shirts when Warnock's opponent, Kelly Loeffler, who he's headed into a runoff with in January, owns a WNBA team. So you have, you know, she's part owner of the Atlanta Dream. She has been incredibly vocal about her opposition to the league's focus on Black Lives Matter. And then you have her very own players, right, donning these shirts and being part of this. You then have the NBA, you know, this summer pulling out the Milwaukee Bucks in response to the shooting of Jacob Blake, and part of bringing sort of, I don't know if it was a boycott or a wildcat strike, we had a lot of trouble sort of placing what the Bucks did by refusing to play. But it started yet again this sort of string of action. Every single major sports league, including globally, had a reaction, had a Black Lives Matter reaction, and then how does the NBA come back to the table? They put election stuff on the table to do that, right? They come back to the game, and part of the conversation is our sports arenas need to be places where people can vote, because we know that the disenfranchisement of so many voters in the United States is connected to the killing of these voting places, of these polling places. So really, we see athletes emerge in really interesting ways. And in the past, we've talked about NASCAR moms and soccer moms, and I think Sarah Palin talked about hockey moms. These are athletes as a voting bloc. And, you know, when you think of someone like LeBron James starting his More Than a Vote campaign, he has 136 million followers across social media. And that's the same number of people who voted in 2016. So the power here, I just think, is something we really need to pay attention to.
Bass referred to a runoff in Georgia for a U.S. Senate seat between Democrat Raphael Warnock, a pastor, and Republican incumbent Kelly Loeffler. And then, when did this all start? Was it with kneeling during the national anthem as a statement against racial injustice? I mean, that started with Colin Kaepernick, former quarterback with the San Francisco 49ers, and then President Trump called it disrespectful, unpatriotic, etc. Started a feud with the NFL. I mean, where did it all germinate?
Well, I think that there's a legacy of African American political agitation and sports. I mean, you know, my first book was about the 68 Olympics and the Black Power action taken there by members of the Olympic Project for Human Rights, who threatened a boycott of the Olympic Games, right? America's best athletes weren't going to go if a civil rights agenda wasn't taken seriously, a list of demands. So we have lots of starts and stops with this. But Colin Kaepernick certainly, you know, reinvigorated that dialogue along with teammates like Eric Reed. And then, yes, you have somebody in a position of power, like Donald Trump, using words that I'm not going to use with you in terms of talking about, you know, what the response should be. And so you have this sort of back and forth conversation, which at its base, I think there are still some people who want to say, look, sports are apolitical. Can't we just play the game? Can't you just stick to sports? Can't you shut up and dribble? And the answer to that is no, because athletes don't stop being who they are and what they believe in when they step on the court or the pitch or the track. They have their belief systems and they have this platform that they have built and they get to use it. And they have.
How did COVID play a role in athletes and voting? I mean, you know, obviously it's changed all of our lives. It touches everything. So what was the impact here with athletes and voting?
Yeah, and sports and COVID is in a really particular moment because I don't think it's an accident that the NBA and the WNBA playing in the so-called bubble and wobble, you know, they're all together 24/7 living the pandemic life and competing. And the NBA and the WNBA pulled that off quite successfully. But they're experiencing a sort of trans team collectivity that they don't usually get. Usually they're crisscrossing the country and you see who your opponent is and then you go on to the next game. And these athletes were basically quarantined together for the remainder of their seasons. And that's how you can build collective consciousness because, you know, Milwaukee Bucks pull out, all the other teams are standing right there with them in the bubble.
Anything else to mention about athletes and voting?
I think the piece that's missing, I think the piece that, you know, just to touch on super quickly is that of the collegiate student athlete. I think that the NCAA highly recommended, pretty much pressured Division I teams to give the student athletes election day off from practice to try to just take down any barriers that they might have to going to vote. And, you know, that's 170,000 athletes right there. So I think that what's going on college campuses, which have always been a place, a source for, you know, sort of political consciousness to go in all sorts of directions, there was a real emphasis on the vote. So it isn't just our pro athletes to keep our eyes on. I think our student athletes are also within this conversation.
Dr. Amy Bass is an author and professor of sports studies at Manhattanville College in Purchase, New York, focusing on sport, culture, and politics. She is chair of the Division of Social Science and Communication. Her most recent book came out in 2018, One Goal, A Coach, A Team, and the Game That Brought a Divided Town Together. She's also an Emmy Award winner for her work with NBC TV at the London Olympics in 2012.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Giustina. Four NASA astronauts blasted off in the SpaceX Crew Dragon spacecraft last weekend. The astronauts will spend up to 6 months at the International Space Station conducting scientific research. Crew 1 is the first crew rotation mission to the orbiting laboratory, with a goal of paving the way for commercial spaceflight. The Legislative Gazette's Jackie Orchard spoke with NASA astronaut Mike Fink about the mission.
What exactly is the mission, and what is your role in that mission?
So this is a really cool thing, right? We used to have space shuttles, and we would send them up and down to build the space station. And then after space shuttle, we stopped flying space shuttles, and the only way to get up to the space station is with the Russians on Russian Soyuz. But now we have American rockets and spacecraft again, including SpaceX's Dragon. And you might remember earlier this year, we sent up a test mission with Bob and Doug, and they stayed aboard space station for a month, and they really helped out. But now we're sending up a full operational mission. We've proven out that the Dragon is safe. It's good for our crew. And we're going to send four people up to the International Space Station, three Americans and my friend from Japan, Soichi Noguchi. And they're going to really work aboard the space station for 6 months and get a whole bunch of science done. And then they're going to come back and splash down off the coast of Florida, kind of like Bob and Doug did. My role in it is I am in the other spacecraft that we're not launching yet, but it's the Boeing Starliner, and we're getting ready for our first flight coming up soon.
Now, the four-person crew will be up there for 6 months. Is that a standard mission time?
Yes. Usually and I say 6 months, it could be 4.5, it could be 5, it could be up to 6. And so we'll see how much, how long we need them and when the rest, when the next crew is ready. So it's going to be about 6 months, and that's the standard trip to the International Space Station. I myself have been up there for over a year on 2 6-month missions.
And when you say they'll be doing some science up there, what do you mean by that?
That's one of the main purposes of our International Space Station. In fact, some people say it is the purpose for the space station. And when you take that out of the equation, you learn so much more about our universe. So there's a whole gamut of biological science, physical science, and they're going to even be growing radishes in space just to learn more about our universe. Some of that science will be commercial. We've been commercializing the space station, and that's how this whole launch is a commercial launch. NASA don't own that spacecraft. It belongs to SpaceX, and we're renting it from them. It's like a rental car. So we're doing the same thing with science. We're doing some commercial science up there. We're even doing some vaccines and some medical science like that. Nothing COVID related, but maybe in the future that's where we make all of our vaccines.
And as you mentioned, this is a collaboration with SpaceX. How do you feel about the mission to Mars?
Oh, well, mission to Mars is a long way in front of us, and it's going to take everyone on the planet kind of working together. It's really hard to get to Mars. We haven't even been back to the moon since 1972, and that's a long time ago. So we're getting our collaborations working. We're getting our new fancy high technology together, and SpaceX is going to be one of the partners with NASA to go to the moon and beyond.
And what preparations are the astronauts going through as they get ready to launch?
So this crew has been training for well over a year for learning how to run the space station, being ready for their science experiments, but also getting how to fly a new spacecraft. That took a lot of work. They are definitely ready. So now they are in quarantine, like super quarantine, not like the regular quarantine that we're all going through now. But they're in super quarantine in Florida. And tomorrow they're going to wake up in the late morning. They're going to put on their spacesuits and walk out to the spacecraft and launch. So they're doing all the very last minute preparations, understanding the weather how the weather's going to be in the morning, and in case they have to make an emergency splashdown where the weather is. They're going through the last minute crew procedures just to make sure they get safely to the space station.
And we've seen launches rescheduled before due to weather. What are the weather conditions that could, reschedule or cancel this launch?
Well, so far, fingers crossed, the weather's looking good in Florida. Things that can affect the weather is if we get a thunderstorm nearby, if we see lots of lightning. In very gentle rain and things like that, the Falcon 9 rocket on which the Dragon sits, the SpaceX complex there, they can go to it can handle it. But if there's lightning or anything or super high winds, we're going to just say, hey, discretion is the better part of valor. And it's much better to do it right a few days later than to risk it too much on game day.
And so, the astronauts arrive at the International Space Station. What are those first actions that they're going to take? What are the priorities of work?
Yeah, so it's really exciting, right? You've been waiting your whole life, or at least the past 4 or 5 years, getting ready for this mission. And then you finally make it and dock to the space station, and you open the doors, and it is such an exciting moment. So they're going to, once they make sure that the Dragon is successfully docked to the space station and has an airtight seal, they're going to open up the hatches on both sides, because there's hatches on both sides. They're going to go through, so there's a nice little tunnel, so nobody has to wear spacesuits or anything like that. They're going to be wearing their finest polo shirts, I believe, for this mission, and they're going to cross the hatch, and immediately we're going to do a quick press conference just to show the world that they made it safely and say how excited they are, because it's a pretty cool historical moment. And as soon as those cameras turn off, it starts a business. And these guys haven't even had a chance to sleep on the Dragon. They're going to be working straight all the way through from the time they woke up. They're going to start. And one of the first things we do aboard the space station is do a safety walkthrough and make sure everybody knows where all the important safety gear is in case there's a depressurization or fire or something like a chemical hazardous gas coming through. And so it's a safety first. Then I think they're going to have a meal together. I know the crew aboard space station is looking forward to the company.
Are we talking a catered filet mignon kind of situation, or what will they be eating?
Oh, we're talking about the finest freeze-dried and thermally stabilized pouches, you know, meals ready to eat that we can provide. So the food aboard Space Station is pretty good, but it's not the same wonderful food that we have here on planet Earth, for sure.
And as you said, this is a historic moment. How is the launch of Crew One changing human spaceflight?
Well, we are providing more options and more access to space. Up until just recently, pretty much the only way to get into space is to be a government astronaut. And right now, we're sending up government astronauts still. But Crew One represents the fact that NASA can buy a service from SpaceX, so can other companies. And there's a company out there, a couple of them, that are working with SpaceX and with Boeing to secure launches that NASA won't have anything to do with, except that if they decide to go to the space station, then we work with them. But pretty much right now, if you have the money, you can go to Boeing or SpaceX and schedule a launch and go fly to space if you want. It's still very expensive, but I think there's some companies that are going to be able to make some good business cases and start making money in space. And once there's money in space that people can realize, that's going to spur American industry and American economy, provide more jobs and more opportunities for people to go fly in space. Only 550 people approximately have ever been into space and in orbit, and I'm very blessed and glad to be one of them, but I really wish more people could see what I've seen.
And this is NASA astronaut Mike Fink. Mike, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, it's fantastic, and a big cheer to all my friends out in Albany, New York.
That's the Legislative Gazette's Jackie Orchard speaking with NASA astronaut Mike Fink. And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 2047. Or just listen or podcast on the web at WAMC.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.